chains down. Sweet liberty, sweet liberty is in our hands. It's part of the plan, or is it a stain?
Listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. It is Tuesday, and it is the first day of March in the year 2005, and we are having a nor'easter. We've had about 10 inches of beautiful, beautiful snow here, and it's been pretty much snowing all day. It's been a light snow, though, so we must have the end of it. And this probably is the grand finale for the winter, and it's a beautiful grand finale to me. I don't know what the weather is like where you are. It's not even real cold here. So that's what makes it especially delightful. Our spiritual message this evening. Last night, I did the prologue of the little book that I've been reading. This is a book I've had for a long time. I've read it in the past and picked it up again, The Journey with the Master. And each evening, I'm going to read you a little passage from the book. And this is the start of the journey. He says, "Come, my beloved, let us go upon a journey together. The day is fair, and the pathway lies before us, the path which is to lead us to the mountain heights of a higher consciousness. This path will, as followed, lead you from from sense consciousness to soul consciousness. I would have you, as you follow this path through the pages of this book, learn to recognize me, your divine helper, in all things. Learn to talk with me as we journey together, and I shall be able to point out to you many beauties of which your eyes are now unaware. We shall spend time together in quiet meditation and contemplation, resting beside pools of living water. You have been taught that divinity dwells upon a throne at the center of your being. Also, that there is a garden of the heart where you can come and meet me, your heart's beloved. These pictures of our relationship are right and of true value. By following this teaching, you have learned to find me close within you and have come to know me for your very own. Now I want you to come yet closer to me than ever before. I want you to know and recognize me as a traveling companion. Know me as spirit within the true self of you, that innermost reality with which you can step forth as pure soul, going on to heights of consciousness which you have never known before. This journey is not a short one, for man does not step at once from a pure sense consciousness to that of soul. The journey will be made up of little daily steps, little overcomings of the faults of daily life, a daily growth of love for the task and devotion to the one who travels the highway with you." And tomorrow night, the title of the next passage is Your Map. And we're going to do something a little bit different here tonight, folks. There's another book I've been reading. I read this book. Actually, it was published in 88, and I probably got it around then. And the title of the book is One, and it's written by Richard Bach. He is the author of Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He wrote a book called Illusions, which was a fascinating little charming book. And the one before this was called The Bridge Across Forever. It was a book about he and his wife. And in the what I'm going to do is I've put sticky notes in some of the passages here because it gives us a lots of room for thought. It is written in a form of a novel, but it's filled with, to me, wonderful thoughts to contemplate. And in the foreword of the book here, first of all, I was going to tell you, this is very much like a movie that I saw. I don't know if any of you or many of you have seen the movie Family Man. Nicolas Cage plays in it, and it's a page of a book about parallel lifetimes. In other words, when we're at a crossroad in our life and we make a choice and are conscious in the experiencing of that choice. And this is a thought that I had read this some time ago in a book called The Seth Material, that whatever we decide, that there is a parallel lifetime of us living what that other choice would have been. It's a deep concept, and I'm not saying I totally grasp it, but I'll tell you what. I recall when I was reading this book the first time, by the time I was finished with it, I had a grasp of the concept that we are all one. We say that, but do we really experience it? And there was just a very short period of time, maybe a couple of days at the most, that when I would be talking to somebody, I would look at them and I would say, that's me. That's an aspect of myself. And I lost it. I can say we are one. We are one spirit, but I don't have the experience of it. And for a while after I had read this book, I had it. Here's the cover of the book, a little bit of an overview. What if space shifted and time bent, and we could meet ourselves as we'll be 20 years from now? What if we could talk face to face with the people we were in the past, with the people we are in parallel lifetimes in alternate worlds? What would we tell them, and what would we ask? What would we change if we knew what waits beyond space and time? As adventurous as Jonathan Livingston Seagull, as playful as illusions, as warm as the bridge across forever, one is Richard Bach's most startling novel yet. Here is his journey with his wife, Leslie, to a realm where survival depends on discovering what other aspects of themselves have learned on roads they never took, where imagination and fear are tools for saving worlds and destroying them, where dying is one step to overcoming death. As the world may not be what it seems, suggests the box, so might we be more than we appear to be. Their book is a curious, loving fantasy in harmony with science and spirit at once, a startling door ajar on a different path to finding ourselves. And when the book starts out, they're on their way to a meeting in San Francisco or someplace in California, and he's an airplane pilot, and they're just getting ready to get their landing instructions, and suddenly this bright light fills the cockpit, and they find themselves over this beautiful ocean. And when they look down, they see beneath the ocean, very shallow water, a whole bunch of different paths and crisscrosses and et cetera. And they weren't sure where they are, where they were. They flew around a while trying to figure out if they were dead or what, and finally decided to try to land. And they picked one of the paths. And so each time that they flew off and picked another path, they met another aspect of themselves. And the first one that I have, the first one that I've highlighted here is, well, the first couple they met were their young selves before they actually ever met. And they found themselves in a hotel room, and both of them in their young selves were in a hotel together, but they didn't know each other. And they both remembered that 16 years before they actually got together, they were both in that elevator together. So they met and talked with their alternate selves and introduced each other and said, here is your soulmate. This is et cetera, et cetera. Well, now they were wondering how... they were wondering how ideas, where ideas come from. They got in the plane and there was this little lady named Pi, who was one aspect of themselves. And they were talking about, you know, what had happened to them. And she was explaining to them where they were in alternate. They were sort of caught in this alternate time. And so she pointed out to them that they're, even though they've been flying, the airplane wasn't running out of gas. They weren't hungry. It was as though time was standing still, although they were having all these experiences. And she asked them, are they afraid? And Leslie thought for a moment, and she smiled and said, not anymore. Richard said, I couldn't say the same. Change is not my favorite sport. And Pi turned to me and said, how much fuel are you using? The gauge was still frozen. None, I said, suddenly understanding. Growly's using no fuel. We're using no fuel because fuel and hunger and thirst are time-related, and there's no time here. Pi nodded. Speed is time-related, said Leslie, but we're moving. Are you? Pi raised her dark eyebrows in question, turned to me. Don't look at me, I said. We're moving only in belief. We're moving only in... And Pi gave an encouraging, you're getting warm signal, as though we were playing charades or 15 questions. We're moving only in belief. We're moving only in consciousness. And she touched the tip of her nose, flashed a bright smile. Exactly. Time is your name for the motion of consciousness. Every possible event that can happen in space and time happens now, at once, simultaneous. There is no past. There is no future, only now. Though we have to use a time-based language so we can talk. It's like, she said, looking up at the ceiling for a simile, it's like arithmetic. As soon as you know the system, you know that every problem in numbers is already answered. The principle of arithmetic already knows that the cube root of 6 already knows the cube root of 6, but it may take us what we call time, a few seconds, to find out what the answer has always been. Every event, asked Leslie, every possible thing that can happen has already happened. There's no future. Nor past, said Pi, nor time. Leslie, ever practical, was exasperated. Then why do we live through all these experiences in this make-believe time? If everything's already done, why bother? The point is not that it's done, but that we have infinite choice, said Pi. Our choices lead us to our experiences. And with experience, we realize that we're not the little creatures we seem to be. We're interdimensional expressions of life, mirrors of spirit. And then Leslie asked where all this happened. And they were talking about the patterns, parallel lifetimes, alternate lifetimes. And Pi said, nothing in space-time is really there. The pattern is a visual, and you've built a visual aid you've built. It's your way of understanding simultaneous lifetimes. When you land, your seaplane floats above the pattern, and your observers, your ghosts, to your alternate worlds, you can learn from what other aspects, your other aspects, without taking their surroundings for real. And she said, listen to this, focus makes one point sharp, and everything else a blur. We focus on one lifetime, and we think that that's all there is. But all those other aspects, the misty ones we take for dreams and wishes and might have been, they're as real as any other. We simply choose our focus. Is this why we're fascinated with physics? I asked, with quantum mechanics, with timelessness. None of it's possible, but it's all of it's true. No past life, no future lives. Zoomed out down to one point, believe it's moving, and we've invented time. Get involved, and we think it's the only life there is that right? Close enough, she said. And they had, as I told you, that one of their first experiences was meeting their alternate selves as a younger couple. And Leslie said, well, then we can fly ahead beyond the point where we left young Richard and Leslie in Carmel. We can land ahead of them and find out whether would they stay together. We can see if they saved those years we lost. You already know, said our other world guide. We don't, I said. We were pulled away. Pi smiled. They have choices, too. One aspect of them is frightened and runs from a future too full of commitment. Another becomes friends, but never lovers. Another becomes lovers, but never friends. Another marries and divorces. Another decides to see each other as soulmates, marry, and loves forever. So we're like tourists here, I said. We don't build the landscape. We just choose which part of it we want to see. That's a nice way of looking at it, said Pi. Okay, I said, let's pretend we fly to a slice of the pattern where we land and keep our mother from meeting our father. If they don't meet, how could we have been born? And Leslie said, no, Richie, that wouldn't stop us from being born. We were born in the part of the pattern where they did meet, and nothing can change that. Nothing's predetermined, I asked. There's no destiny. Of course there's destiny, said Pi, but destiny doesn't push you where you don't want to go. You're the ones who choose. Destiny is up to you. And then they were wanting to know if they could get hurt if they stayed there and continued their journey. Could they get hurt off in some other time? Can we even get hurt even though we're ghosts? And Pi said, you can choose that if you wish. Choose it. It sounded ominous to me. I take my adventures lightly. Flying into the utterly unknown is not adventure, it's insanity. Could we get caught in this pattern of belief and lose the world we had? What if we got separated and never found each other again? Beliefs can be ferocious traps. And anyway, he said he thought that they should go back. And Leslie said, no, let's take the trip and let's see. Let's learn from it. And he sighed and he said, Leslie's past is all brave choices in search of truth and principle. Of course, she chose to stay. Now she appealed to the explorer at the edge of my mind. Okay, little darling, I said. The air was heavy with underestimated risk. I felt like a student pilot off to learn slow rolls without a safety belt. Pi, how many aspects of us are there anyway? She laughed, looked out the window to the pattern below. How many can you imagine? There's no counting. That whole pattern is us, said Leslie, dumbfounded. As far as we can see, as far as we can fly, the pattern is our choices. She nodded. We haven't started, I thought, and it's already beyond believing. What about everybody else, Pi? Listen to this, folks. How many lives can there be in one universe? She looked at me puzzled, as if she didn't understand my question. How many lives in the universe, Richard? She asked. One. And so then they were talking about how they were going to decide which landing pattern. And Ty said, intuition is your guide here. One level of you knows everything there is to know. Find that level, ask for guidance, and trust that you'll be led wherever you most need to go. Try it. And so then I'm going to skip over, folks. And the next one, they met his young self, Richard Bach's young self, when he was just finishing flight school. And so they found themselves there on the tarmac. And the figure, it says a figure appeared at the wing of the airplane. Who's there? Are you all right? He wore a dark nylon flight suit and jacket, a dim ghost himself in the moonlight, white embroidered pilot's wings on the jacket, yellow second lieutenant's bars. And Leslie whispered, "You go, I'll stay here." So he said, "I'm fine," walking around the wing toward him. "Permission to join you? Who is it?" And Richard said, "Oh, why must he ask such hard questions, sir?" I answered, "Second Lieutenant Bach, Richard D., AO308-0774, sir." "Mize, is that you?" he chuckled. "What are you doing out here clowning around?" Phil Meisenhalter, I thought. What a friend he was. In 10 years, he'll be dead, shot down with his F-105 in Vietnam. "It's not Mize," I said. "It's Richard Bach. It's you from your future, 30 years from tonight." He peered through the dark. "You're who?" If we do much more of this, I thought, we better get used to that question. "I'm you, Lieutenant. I'm yourself with a little more experience. And I'm the one made all the mistakes that you're going to make and somehow survived." He walked closer, inspecting me in the dark, still thinking that this was a joke. "I'm going to make mistakes," he said with a smile. "That's hard to believe." "Well, call them unexpected learning experiences," he said. "I think I can handle them." "You've already made the big one," I pressed on. "You joined the military. Smart thing would be to quit now." "Not the smart thing, the wise thing would be to quit." "Huh. I just graduated from flight school. I still can't believe I'm an Air Force pilot, and you're telling me quit? That's pretty good. What else do you know?" If he thought I was a game, he was willing to play it. "Okay," I said. "In the past, I remember that I thought I was using, I thought the Air Force, I thought I was using the Air Force to learn how to fly. Fact is, the Air Force was using me, and I didn't even know it." "But I do know it," he said. "I happen to love my country, and if there's fighting to be done to keep it free, I want to be there. Remember Lieutenant Wyeth? Tell me about him." And he looked at me sideways, uneasy. "The name is Wyeth," he corrected, "instructor in pre-flight training. Something happened to him in Korea, and he went a little crazy. He stood in front of our class and wrote in big letters on the board, capital letters, exclamation, killers. And then he turned around, his face like grinning death, and he said, 'That's you.' You know what you're going to learn in your future, Richard?" I said, "You're going to find out that Lieutenant Wyeth was the sanest person you'll ever meet in the Air Force." He shook his head. "You know," he said, "every once in a while, I imagine what it would be like to meet you, to talk to the man I'm going to be in 30 years. You're not like him, not at all. He's proud of me." "I'm proud of you too," I said, "but for different reasons than you think. I'm proud because I know that you're doing the best you know how to do. I'm not proud that the best you know is to volunteer to kill people, to strafe and rocket and napalm villages full of terrified women and children. Like hell I will, he said. I'm going to fly air-to-air day defense, fighter defense. I didn't say a word. Well, air defense is what I'd like to do. I just looked at him in the dark. Hey, I'm serving my country, and I'll do whatever. You could serve your country 10,000 other ways, I said. Come on, why are you here? Are you honest enough with yourself to even to know? He hesitated. I want to fly. You knew how to fly before you joined the Air Force. You could have flown Piper Cubs and Cessnas. They're not fast enough, though. Well, not like the pictures on the recruiting posters, are they? Cessnas aren't like the airplanes in the movies. No, he said at last. So why are you here? Well, there's something about high performance. He checked himself. As honest now as he knew how to be, there's something about fighter planes. There's a glory there that nothing else has. Tell me about the glory. The glory comes from a mastery of the thing, flying this airplane. He patted the wing of the Sabre lovingly. Well, I'm not plodding around in the mud. I'm not tied to desks or buildings or anything on Earth. I can go faster than sound, 40,000 feet up. No other living thing has ever been there, practically. Something in me knows we're not ground creatures. Says we don't have limits. And the closest I can come to living what I know is true is flying one of these. Of course, that's why I had wanted the speed and dazzle and flash. I'd never put it in words, never put it in thoughts, just felt it. And then he said, I hate when they hang bombs on the airplanes, but I can't help that. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any machines like this. Without you, I thought war would die. I swept my hand towards the Sabre. To this day, I consider it the loveliest airplane that's ever been built. Beautiful, I said. Bait. Bait? The fighter planes are bait. You're the fish. So what's the hook? The hook is going to kill you when you find out, I said. The hook is that you, Richard Bach, human being, are personally responsible for every man and woman and child that you'll kill with this thing. Wait a minute. I'm not responsible. I have nothing to do with decisions like that. I follow orders. Orders are no excuse. The Air Force is no excuse. War is no excuse. Every murder will haunt you till you die. Every night you will wake up screaming, killing everyone again, over and over. He stiffened. Listen, without the Air Force, if we're attacked, I'm here to protect our freedom. You said you were here because you want to fly and for the glory. My flying protects my country. Yeah, that's what the others say, too, word for word. The Russian soldiers, Chinese soldiers, Arab soldiers, the fill-in-the-blank soldiers of the fill-in-the-blank nations. They learn in us we trust. Defend the motherland, the fatherland, from them. But their them, Richard, is you. His arrogance suddenly disappeared. We're going to take a short break here, folks, and we'll be back right after this.
Listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dove.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Okay, we're back. And what I'm doing is reading excerpts of a book called One, titled One by Richard Bach. And we're talking right now. This is the part of their journey, he and his wife, where they met his younger self, who's just got his flying wings, just gotten through flight school. And he said that flying protects his country, the young Richard. And, of course, the present Richard knows better than this. And he said, I'll just repeat what I read before the break here. He said that my flying protects my country. And Richard said, that's what the others say, too, word for word. The Russian soldiers, the Chinese soldiers, the Arab soldiers, the fill-in-the-blank soldiers of the fill-in-the-blank nations. They learn, in us we trust. Defend the motherland, the fatherland, from them. But their them, Richard, is you. His arrogance suddenly disappeared. Remember the model airplanes, he said, almost pleading? 1,000 model airplanes, and a tiny me flew in every one. Remember climbing trees, looking down? I was the bird waiting to fly. Remember throwing yourself from diving boards, pretending it was flight? Remember the first time up in Paul Marcus Globeswift? I wasn't the same for days. I wasn't the same ever. That's the way it's planned, I said. Planned? Soon as you learn to see pictures, soon as you learn to listen to stories and songs, soon as you learn to read books and signs and posters, flags and movies and statues and tradition, classes in history, Pledge of Allegiance, salute the flag. There is us and there is them. Them will hurt us if we're not vigilant, suspicious, angry, armed. Follow orders. Do as you're told. Defend your country. Encourage the boy children's curiosity in machines that move, automobiles, ships, airplanes. Now, set before them the most excellent of these magical machines in one place, in the military, in the armed forces of every country in the world. Hulk the auto drivers in million-dollar tanks. Launch the sea lovers to command nuclear cruisers. Offer the would-be flyers, offer you, Richard, the fastest airplanes in history, all your very own. And you get to wear this flashy helmet and visor, and you get to paint your name on the side of the cockpit. They lead you on. Are you good enough? Are you tough enough? They praise you, elite, top gun. They drape you in flags, pin you with wings on your pockets, bars on your shoulders, bright ribbon medals for doing just as you're told by the ones who pull your strings. There are no truth in advertising rules for recruiting posters. The pictures show jets. They don't say, by the way, if you're not killed flying this airplane, you'll die on the cross of your personal responsibility for the people you kill with it. This is not dumb others, Richard. This is you, eating the bait and proud of it. Proud as a grand free marlin in your handsome blue uniform, hooked on this airplane, hauled by the line toward your own death, your own grateful, proud, honorable, patriotic, pointless, stupid death. And the United States won't care, and the Air Force won't care, and the general who gives you orders won't care either. The only one who's ever going to care that you killed the people you're going to kill is you. You and them and their families. some glory, Richard. I turned and walked away, left him at the wing of the fighter. Our lives so destined by indoctrination, I thought, that there is no changing. Would I change? Would I listen to me if I were him? He didn't raise his voice or call out after me. He spoke as though he hadn't noticed I had left. What do you mean I'm responsible? What an odd feeling. I was talking with myself, but his mind was no longer mine to change. We can only transform our lives in the split-second eternity that is our now. If we move one moment from that now, it's somebody else's choice. I strained to catch his voice. How many people will I kill? I walked back to join him. In 1962, you'll be sent to Europe with the 478th Tactical Fighter Squadron. It will be called the Berlin Crisis. You will memorize routes to one primary and two secondary targets. There's a pretty good chance, 5 years from now, that you'll drop a hydrogen bomb on the city of Kiev. I watched him. Mostly, the city is known for its publishing and its film industry. But what will matter to you are the railroads in the middle of town and the machine tool factories at the edge. How many people? There will be 900,000 people in Kiev that winter. And if you follow orders, the few thousand that survive your attack will wish they were dead too. 900,000 people. Temper short, national pride at stake, safety of the free world, I said, one ultimatum after another. Did you drop the bomb? He was tense as steel, listening to his future. I opened my mouth to say no, that the Soviets backed down, but my mind went silver with rage. Some alternate me from a different past Holocaust grabbed my neck and spoke fury, a razor voice, desperate to get through. Of course I did. I didn't question any more than you question. I thought, if there's a war, the president's the one with all the facts. He makes the decisions. He's responsible. I never thought, till takeoff, that the president can't be responsible for dropping the bomb because the president doesn't know how to fly an airplane. I struggled to gain control. The president doesn't know a missile launch key from a rudder pedal. The commander-in-chief can't start the engine. He can't taxi to the runway. Without me, he'd be one harmless fool in Washington. And the world would muddle along without his nuclear war. But Richard, that fool had me. He didn't know how to kill a million people, so I did it for him. The bomb wasn't his weapon. I was his weapon. I never put it together then. A handful of us in the world know how. And without us, there could be no war. I destroyed Kiev. Can you believe this? I incinerated 900,000 people because some crazy told me to do it. The lieutenant stood, mouth open, watching me. Did the Air Force teach you ethics, I hissed? Ever have a class called Accountability of Fighter Pilots? You never had and you never will. The Air Force says, follow orders, do as you're told, your country right or wrong. It doesn't tell you that what you've got to live with is your conscience, right or wrong. You follow your orders to burn Kiev, and 6 hours later, a fellow you'd really like if you knew him, a pilot named Pavel Chernov, follows his orders and cremates Los Angeles. Everybody dies. If you murder yourself, when you kill the Russians, why kill them at all? But I promised to follow orders. At once, the madman let go of my throat in despair and disappeared. I tried to reason once more. What will they do to you if you spare a million lives? If you don't follow orders, I asked. Call you a non-professional pilot, court-martial you, kill you? Would that be worse than what you would have done to the city of Kiev? He looked at me for a long moment in silence. If you could tell me anything, he said finally, and I'd promise to remember, what would you say? That you're ashamed of me? I sighed, feeling weary. Oh, kid, it'd be a lot easier on me if you'd just shut your mind and insist that you're right, following orders. Why do you have to be such a nice guy? Because I'm you, sir, he said. So anyway, they were getting ready to leave, he and Leslie. He said I straightened at once, catching a glimpse. Oh, I felt a touch on my shoulder, and I looked up to the sheen of golden hair in moonlight. Introduce me, said Leslie. Shadows showed a sorceress in the night. I straightened at once, catching a glimmer of what she intended. Lieutenant Bach, I said, meet Leslie Parrish, your soulmate. Your wife-to-be, the woman that you've been looking for, the one you'll find at the end of many adventures, at the beginning of the best. Hello, she said. Hello, he faltered. You say, my wife? That time may come, she said softly. Are you sure you mean me? There's a young Leslie this moment, she said, starting her career, wondering who you are, where you are, when you're going to meet. The young man was starstruck at the sight of her. For years he had dreamed her, loved her, knew she waited somewhere in the world for him. I can't believe this, he said. You're from my future? One of your futures, she said. But how can we meet? Where are you now? We can't meet till you're out of the military. In some futures, we'll never meet at all. But if we're soulmates, we have to meet, he said. Soulmates are born to spend their lives together. She stepped back from him, a small step, maybe not. Never has she looked more lovely than she does tonight, I thought. How much he wants to fly across time to find her. I didn't think anything could... What power is there that can keep soulmates apart? He asked. Was it my wife speaking or an alternate Leslie from her own different time? My dearest Richard, she said, in that future, when you bomb Kiev and your Russian friend, the Flyer, bombs Los Angeles, the studio at 20th Century Fox where I'll be working is less than a mile from Ground Zero. I'll be dead a second after the first bomb falls. She turned to me, a flash of terror in her eyes. The purpose of our lives together lost. There are some futures, cried that other self. Soulmates don't always meet. I was with her at once, my arm around her, holding her. While the terror passed, we can't change it, I said. She nodded, anguish gone, knowing before I did. You're right, she said sadly, and she turned her face to the lieutenant. It's not our choice, it's yours. The best we could say, we had said, the best we knew, he knew. Somewhere in our simultaneous future, Leslie did as Pye had said. And anyway, they got into the airplane and took off. The night sky and the fighter planes and the airbase shuddered about us, the lieutenant himself saying, wait, and gone. Dear God, I thought, women and children and men, lovers and bakers, actresses, musicians, comedians, doctors, librarians, the lieutenant would kill them all. No mercy when some president orders puppies and birds and trees and flowers and fountains, books and museums and paintings. He'll burn his own soulmate to death. And nothing we can say will stop him. He's me, and I can't stop him. Leslie read my mind, held my hand. Richard, sweetheart, listen. Maybe we couldn't have stopped him, but maybe we did. Gives us a little insight, doesn't it, folks? And the next one I'm going to do is where they... just a minute here. Well, they met Attila the Hun. It was one of Richard's... alternate selves, They wound up there in the tent, and he saw them. Nobody else could see them but him, because he was an alternate self, and he was trying to kill them and couldn't. Finally, he stopped, and Richard shouted at him, and he said, "No more violence." He stopped glaring at me. What was frightening about the eyes was not their cruelty, but their intelligence. When this man destroyed, it was no accident. "Can you talk?" I asked, though I didn't expect he'd know English. "Who are you?" He scowled, breathing hard, and then to my amazement, he answered. Whatever his language, we understood. He touched his chest. "Etala," he said proudly. "Etala, the scourge of God." "Etala," said Leslie. "Attila? Attila the Hun?" And so the warrior grinned fiercely at my shock, and then his eyes narrowed again. He called his guard in. The guard came in, and he killed the guard. And he killed the guard, he said, because if his guard could not see visitors in his tent, he didn't deserve to live. And Richard said, "Why?" He shrugged, lifted his head in disdain. "If my guard cannot see what I see in my own tent?" "No," I said. "Why are you so vicious? Why so much murder, so much destruction? Not just this man, but whole cities, whole peoples you destroy for no reason." He was filled with contempt. "Coward, would you have me ignore the aggressions of an evil empire? Roman imperialists and their lackey puppets? Infidels. Listen, folks, God tells me, sweep the land of infidels, and I obey God's word." The eyes glittered, quoting, "Woe unto you, lands of the west, for I shall set my scourge upon you. The scourge of God shall slay your men. Under the wheels of my chariot shall fall your women and your children under my horse's hoof." "God's word," I said. Empty syllables, more powerful than arrows, for no one dares stand against them. How simply the quick grasp power from fools. He looked wide-eyed at me. "You speak my words. First, turn merciless," I went on, shocked at what I was saying, "and then claim that you're the scourge of God, and your enemies swell with those too dim to imagine a loving God. Excuse me, your armies swell with those too dim to imagine a loving God, too frightened to challenge an evil one. Shout that God promises women oranges, wine, all the gold of Persia when they die with the blood of infidels on their words, and you have a force that turns cities to rebels. To seize power, call up God's word, for that word best shifts fear to rage at any enemy you choose." We stared at each other, Attila and I. They were his words. They had also been mine. He knew it, and so did I. And then Leslie spoke up. She said, "If you believed that power comes from fear, if you believe that power comes from fear, you lock yourself in with those who deal in fear. It's not a very bright crowd, and what a foolish choice for a man with your mind. If only you'd use that mind for woman," he roared. "Be silent. You are feared by those who honor fear," she said softly. "You could be loved by those who honor love." He righted his chair, sat facing me, his back to Leslie, bitter anger in every line of his face as he quoted his scripture. "God says, I shall bring low your high towers and your walls to ruin, and no stone of your city shall stand upon another." Those are God's orders. I have no orders to love. If rage could boil, this man was his cauldron. "I hate God," he said. "I hate what he commands, but no other God will speak." We didn't answer. "Your God of love, never does he raise his sword against me. Never does he show his face." He sprang to his feet, lifted the massive chair in one hand, hurled it down the wood, dissolving in splinters. "If he's so mighty, why does he not stand in my way?" Anger is fear. I knew that. Every angry person is a frightened one, dreading some loss. And never had I seen a person so angry as this mirror of my own savage fighter, my locked and barred inner self. "Why are you so frightened?" I ask. He stalked me with fire in his eyes. "You dare? You dare to call Attila frightened? I shall have you cut in pieces and fed to the jackals." I clenched my fist in despair. "But you can't touch me, Attila. You can't hurt me, and I can't hurt you. I am your own spirit, come 2,000 years from your future. You cannot hurt me? No. You would if you could? No." He thought about that for a moment. "Why not? I am death, the scourge of God." "Please," I said, "no more lies. Why are you so frightened?" Had the chair not been in pieces, he would have smashed it again. "Because I am alone in an insane world," he bellowed. "God is wicked. God is cruel. And I must be cruelest of all to be king. God commands, kill or die." And then all at once he sighed heavily, his fury passed. "I'm alone with monsters," he said so softly we could barely hear. "Nothing makes sense." And they left there. And the next place they went to, and I hope I can get through this because it kind of all connects together. They found themselves in a beautiful field, grass spread around us like an emerald pond, cupped in mountains, sunset flame from crimson clouds. They wondered where they were, and Leslie thought that they were in France. She said, "Look." She pointed to a cleft in the rock where an old man in a coarse brown robe knelt on the ground near a campfire. He was welding, brilliant, yellow-white, flickered and danced on the rocks behind him. "What's a welder doing up here?" she asked. And then she watched for a moment. "He's not welding. He's praying." Closer, and we saw, sure enough, there was no welding torch, no sound, no smoke. It was a flaring, sun-colored pillar pulsing above the ground, less than a yard from the elder. And this is what it said. "And to the world shall you give as you have received," came a gentle voice from the light. "Give to all who yearn to know the truth, from whence we come, the reason for our being, and the course that lies ahead on the way to our forever home." We stopped a few yards behind him, transfixed by the sight. I had seen that brilliant light once before in my life years ago, had been stunned by one accidental glimpse of what to this day I still call love. The light we saw this moment was the same, so radiant it rendered the world a footnote, a dim asterisk. Anyway, after the light was gone, there was a manuscript, and Leslie walked forward and picked it up, and the old man could speak to them. Anyway, it was a communication of ideas, and anyone in any language would be to understand it. Listen to this, folks. "You are creatures of light. From light have you come. To light shall you go, and surrounding you through every step is the light of your infinite being. By your choice dwell you now in the world which you have created. What you hold in your heart shall be true, and what most you admire, that shall you become. Fear not, nor be dismayed at the appearance that is darkness, at the disguise that is evil, at the empty cloak that is death, for you have picked these for your challenges. They are the stones on which you choose to whet the keen edge of your spirit. Know that ever about you stands the reality of love, and each moment you have the power to transform your world by what you have learned." The pages went on, hundreds of them. We leaped through, struck in awe. You are life, inventing form. No more can you die on sword or years than you can die on doorways through which you walk, one room into another. Every room gives its word for you to speak. Every passage its song for you to sing. Leslie looked at me, her eyes luminous. If this writing could touch us so, I thought, we from the 20th century, what effect would it have on people from the, whatever this was, the 12th? We turned back to the manuscript. No words of ritual, no directions for worship, no calling down fire and destruction on enemies, no disasters for unbelievers, no cruel Attila gods. It didn't mention temples or priests or rabbis or congregations or choirs or customs or holy days. It was scripture written for the loving inner being and for that being only. Turn these ideas loose in this century, I thought. A key to recognize our power over belief. Unleash the power of love, and terror will vanish. With this, the world can sidestep the dark ages. Well, anyway, we're out of time. Anyway, they were talking to this Jean-Paul Leclerc. He bowed. He said, these words are key to the truth for any who will read. They are life to those who will listen. And we're out of time. I might, maybe, and maybe not. Basically, the rest of their conversation, folks, was how religions are made. I might finish this tomorrow night. I hope you'll come back. That's what I... And here's a quote in the back of the book, one of his alternate selves. A man who never did anything but said, I could do all of these things. And his wife said, if we had had children, what would you tell them? And he said some very profound words. And he said, I gave my life to become the person I am right now. Was it worth it? We'll see you tomorrow night, folks. Thank you for being here. God bless you. And good night.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to firstamendmentradio.com.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
What do you know about the FTAA, the proposed free trade area?